This is Jim Inkster coming today on Talk Louisiana. We'll be visiting with the maestro of Baton Rouge Symphony, conductor Tim Muffet, a major performance from BRSO this week. Also, Chris Cangelosi and Michael Uffman on the Baton Rouge version of Dancing with the Stars, which is coming soon. And we'll talk with General Russell Honoré. The general has some comments in his role as head of the Green Army and the legislative agenda at the Capitol, and also about what's happened with the victims of the BP oil spill 8 years later. And we'll hear from King Alexander, the president of LSU, and Alexander Chebineau, a noted director. A film called Fail State is showing this week to start the Louisiana International Film Festival. All this coming soon, as in a few minutes, but now the news on 89.3 WRKF. Good morning. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Hope you had a great weekend, and we're glad you're listening to WRKF. If you'd like to send us an email, you can do so at talk@talklouisiana.org. And our leadoff guest is Tim Muffet, the maestro of the Baton Rouge Symphony, the longest-serving conductor in the history of BRSO. And this week's a big week for him. And if you'd like to talk with Maestro Muffet, 877-217-5757 or 297-5633 in Baton Rouge. And this is a baseball week at the Symphony.
Yes,
a lot of bats and balls at the River Symphony. Yeah.
In the imagination and in the mind, we will have baseball fields and nights and birds singing and lights and summer air and all of that. It's a remarkable experience.
Well, baseball is a sport that inspires a lot of imagination. It's inspired some great literature through the years. And now we're going to blend words and music, and you have a few luminaries who are involved in this production.
We should, yeah, this is the whole program is kind of an American icon program, and one of our icons is Skip Bertman, the legendary collegiate coach. I'm sure all of your listeners know who he is. This is a really wonderful piece of music written by an American composer named Fred Sturm. It's a jazz-inspired piece in a lot of ways, and it sets a wonderful text from a former baseball commissioner.
Bart Giamatti, right?
Yes, Bart Giamatti, correct. Sets this text to music in a very powerful and profound way. And Skip does a great job. We had our first rehearsal last night, and he was all over it. It was fantastic.
He's a month shy of his 80th birthday coming May 23rd. And I'm sure if he's listening, he's very pleased that I told the world about that. But he, of course, won five national championships, World Series titles at LSU. And he came here 1984, so that's 34 years ago. And talk about a guy who's part of the fabric of our community, Skip Bertman is.
Right. When I came to him with this concept about a year ago, he didn't even hesitate. You know, he said anything to help out the symphony, and we sure appreciate that. It's wonderful to build a bridge, you know, like this and bringing in the sports world in with the artistic world, and in a really meaningful way. This isn't a gimmick piece. This is a strong piece.
He's a good ad-libber. Hopefully he'll stick to the script.
Well, he did in rehearsal anyway, so we'll see how it goes as the week progresses.
Well, Bart Giamatti, he was from Yale University, became commissioner of baseball, suspended Pete Rose for life. Mm-hmm. And then dropped dead like a week later, just suddenly, as a very relatively young man. His son's a very good actor, Paul, by the way. But
sure.
But he has quite a legacy. But he was a guy who obviously loved baseball, but he was a man of words as well.
Right. And this text is really beautiful. I think even for the people in the audience that maybe wouldn't consider themselves baseball fans, they're going to get caught up in the emotional content of this, and it's more. It isn't just about baseball, but it's about the cycle of life. It's about the human experience, and it's a really powerful work. We're excited to present it. Fred Sturm, American composer,
and you've got some other activities Thursday night in addition to baseball.
Right. So, like I said, it's an American icon program. The first work is by Aaron Copland, an icon in and of himself, and then it's his ballet score to Billy the Kid, which is a very graphic in a good way. Mm-hmm. it's his ballet score, so it's a depiction of the story of Billy the Kid really beautifully. Then we'll go on to the baseball work, and then we finish with Leonard Bernstein's The Symphonic Dances from West Side Story. Again, a couple of icons here. Leonard Bernstein, of course, being one. We're celebrating his 100th anniversary of his birth this year, and then all of the cast of West Side Story, even though they aren't there in person, come through in the power of the music.
Leonard Bernstein. He lived at the Dakota in New York with John Lennon.
Right.
Imagine those two talking to each other.
Yes. Yeah.
And Rex Reed,
right.
Great LSU luminary. But it's going to be quite a performance Thursday night, Raising Cane's River Center. The time you start?
7:30. This is in the performing the Theater for Performing Arts.
It's actually
arts.
The which is separate from the RC Squared.
Right.
Same place. You know where to go if you've been to the symphony.
They all know where to go. 7:30, and I'll do a pre-concert talk at 6:30 if you want to hear a little bit.
That's always a highlight.
Behind the scenes, right? I'll tell you a little bit about what went into some of this music and kind of a behind-the-music story there.
And Tim Muffett will be impeccably groomed and dressed as always, right?
Yeah. Thanks to Manuel Martinez, of course. Keeps me looking good.
Yeah, there's a rumor that Manuel is doing some work for the governor now, so that may be why Governor Edwards looks very nice these days. He always did, but especially so.
That goes a long way, certainly.
Yeah, Manuel can do a lot.
Yes.
But next week, you'll be back. Not resting on your laurels for this week. There's another major production, and this one will be down the street.
Right. So this brings our Masterwork series to a close on Thursday night, and then the Lamar Family Chamber Series wraps up the following Thursday, April 26th, with a wonderful program with our principal string players, the String Quartet of the Baton Rouge Symphony. And these are extraordinary artists that everyone in the community knows these people at this point. And they have a great program of Debussy and Ravel at the First Methodist Church Thursday night. Love to see everyone out for that.
Ashley notes that the Chicago performance, we talked about that your last time here. That went rather well, didn't it?
Oh, that was unbelievable. I knew it would be good, but I was amazed at how great they sounded.
Really?
They just knocked it out of the park. It was an unbelievable evening of music making. Mm-hmm.
And people might think Chicago and the Baton Rouge Symphony, but it worked, didn't it?
Yeah, it was a fantastic night.
And you like all kinds of music.
Absolutely. Duke Ellington said it best. There are only two kinds of music, great music and the other kind. There's great music in every genre, in every style, I should say, yeah.
And Baton Rouge has always responded well to these so-called pop concerts.
I think so. You know, we try to choose them carefully so that they're relevant and so that they reach a broad group of people. And we don't put on programs just for the sake of doing concerts. We try to do things that really will have an impact and relevance and be well-received by the people here.
And here's a question. This one's come up a time or two in the past. Roman asking about Chris Bode.
Right.
Yeah, is he coming back anytime soon?
Well, we had two wonderful experiences with Chris Bode in the past, and he's certainly someone that comes up for discussion. Yes,
but the fact that he came here twice is quite significant.
It is, yeah. There aren't many artists that we brought back more than once. We brought back Itzhak Perlman twice. We brought back Renee Fleming twice, and Chris Bode.
Yeah. Chris Bode, but he put on quite a show.
Yeah, that was a wonderful time.
Well, in the we know what's happening in the next 2 weeks now, and the second one, by the way, is at the First United Methodist Church.
Correct.
That's the one next Thursday. This Thursday, the Performing Arts Center at the River Center. But after that, what's happening for the remainder of the season?
Well, that brings our season to a close.
That's it?
Yes, and we're ramping up now to kick off the 18-19 season in September.
And when do you announce what's in the offing there?
That's not too far off in the distance. Yeah, one thing I do want to mention is that this is going to be the last chance to hear the Baton Rouge Symphony on Thursday night in the River Center as it currently stands, because it will be closed next year for renovation. So if you're a nostalgic person, come check it out. This is your last chance.
Well, I'm sure it'll be bigger and better when it's renovated, but that's always a process. So what happens in the interim?
Well, we're looking at some other venues in the community that can take us, and I think we've got some good things in the offering, and we're going to make the most of it. We're trying to take this situation and adapt our programming to the individual spaces where we will find ourselves and really try to take advantage of it.
Well, the Performing Arts Center holds how many? What's the capacity?
1,900.
1,900. Mm-hmm. So you need a pretty big arena. There aren't that many opportunities to find a
right.
a 1,900-seat arena with the acoustics and all the things you need to put on a spectacular show.
We're anticipating high demand for our tickets next year because there will not be quite as much supply.
Is that a hint on where it might be?
Well, when we're ready, I'll fill you in when we've got everything signed, sealed, and delivered.
Well, it's going to be quite a show for the Baton Rouge Symphony this week, and as Tim Muffet said, this Thursday will be the last performance at the Performing Arts Center for a while. Do you know how long? Is it going to be 1 year, 2 years?
Well, they're telling us 1 year. We have a contingency plan, though, if that's not the case.
What was it? Freud said intelligence is the ability to adapt. Well, you're going to have to adapt,
right.
And so will the audience.
Right. We not only want to adapt, but we want to take advantage of it. We want to take this and turn it into something.
But when you think back on all the performances in that arena, though,
right.
It's pretty easy to get emotional about it. You've had some unbelievable moments.
It has been a great relationship, and we look forward to a new and improved one.
Well, this week it's Skip Bertman baseball, and then Aaron Copland, and the Baton Rouge Symphony at its peak. And if you'd like more information, brso.org, brso.org. Thank you, Tim Muffet.
Thank you, Jim.
We're back after this pause with more Talk Louisiana. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for listening to Talk Louisiana, and we're joined now by the president of Louisiana State University, F. King Alexander, and he is always a busy man, and this week he's going to do something at the university that he doesn't normally do, and that's be part of a special screening for a movie that premieres the Louisiana International Film Festival. And if you want more information beyond our discussion today about this particular offering or any of the other of the more than 50 films that we'll be showing, lifilmfest.org is where to go. But Dr. Alexander will be there Wednesday night at the Patrick Taylor Hall, 7:30, for a screening of Fail State. It is refocusing the debate on solutions that can fix the student loan and education crisis. And good morning to you, King Alexander.
Good morning, Jim, and congratulations again. I'd just like your listeners to know that you were inducted into the Alumni Association Hall of Fame and as one of our great graduates on Friday night. So congratulations again.
Well, thank you so much, and it was nice to see you there, and I appreciate all that King Alexander is doing for the university during some rather challenging times. And this film kind of dovetails with that. You, I think, have seen it. What's your take on particularly the student loan crisis and how students are being affected by this beyond their educational experiences? Many have this burden for years and years to come.
Well, it's actually a very well-researched documentary. It's about an hour and a half, and it takes you through the last 50 years of how we got into this situation where there's about $1.3 trillion in student loan debt that's out there. And some of the institutions that have taken advantage of this issue, while others have tried to fight for survival, and a lot of low-income kids have been taken advantage of. So it's a very well-researched documentary that everybody needs to be aware of because it really shows you where we are today and gets everybody thinking about where do we want to be in the next 10 or 20 years.
$1.3 trillion, that's a huge number.
In fact, it's past credit card debt as the nation's second highest level of indebtedness. Only home mortgages exceed the debt limit that students have. And we're very proud, as we did in speaking with 5,000 parents on Saturday, that we're among the lowest as an institution in graduating students with debt, and about half of what the national average is. But there are a lot of universities and colleges and street corner institutions that are taking advantage of a lot of students.
877-217-5757 is your number, and you can send us an email to talk@talklouisiana.org. We're visiting with President King Alexander of LSU, and we're joined also by the director of Fayal State, Alexander Chebineau, and he is the one who has put this together and has mentioned the special screening. The other productions from the film festival will be at Perkins Row, but this one's at LSU, Wednesday night, Patrick Taylor Hall, 7:30. And Alexander Chebineau, how did you get involved with this particular concept and project?
Thanks a lot, Jim. So I started the film. I was a recent college graduate myself, my producer and I, Julia Glossy, and we just graduated. We had some student loan debt, and we were really passionate about this issue. And so we said, you know, who better to make a film than people who kind of just went through it, because it's just a different perspective than, you know, your typical, you know, higher ed policy wonk or anyone like that. So we actually started making a film on student loan debt specifically, and about 15 interviews into the production, or June 2014, Corinthian Colleges, which was this massive for-profit college company, had multiple different for-profit chains across the country, multiple billion dollars a year in revenue, began its collapse. And the best equivalent that I have of that is something like a Lehman Brothers during the subprime mortgage crisis. And so at that point, you know, up until that point, I was, you know, kind of a little naive about the whole situation with for-profit colleges. I'd known that there was some bad stuff. You know, there had been a 60 Minutes on it, Frontline, TBS Frontline. But I kind of wanted to make a film about all of higher education. But when Corinthian Colleges happened, I was like, okay, what's the story here? What's going on? And I started pulling as much as I could, research-wise on this industry. And it was clear very quickly just how bad it was. I remember one specific instance where I came across a recent settlement in Kentucky led by Attorney General Jack Conway against this company called QuinStreet, which is a lead generation service for the for-profit college industry. And they operated this website called gibill.com. And the website effectively masqueraded as a government website. It looked like military service members and veterans could only use their benefits at for-profit colleges. And when I saw that, I was like, this has to be exposed. This has to be stopped. And so from that point forward, we started making a film on for-profit colleges, exposing the industry, looking at how these institutions are largely, you know, low quality, high tuition, oftentimes lack proper accreditation. So we spoke with a number of students who wanted to become a nurse or a police officer, and they went through the entire program. And when they finished, they realized, or they found out that their credits wouldn't be accepted by their local police department. So they'd just taken on, you know, $60,000 plus in debt for a degree that was effectively worthless.
All right. A question from Holly in the Garden District asking what happens to students who are unable to pay back their debt. What happens in that case?
So you might have already heard of it. In the general news media, it talks a lot about how, you know, you can't file for bankruptcy with student loan debt. And this is largely done to appease private bank lenders when the student loans were being serviced by the banking industry. And that's been kept through when Obama converted it to government process loans and things like that. And so in a lot of cases, we're seeing horror stories where people who fall behind on their student loans, or maybe a parent co-sign for student loans, or even grandparents co-sign, where they're just drowning in student loan debt. In some instances, I spoke with some people, they were very long retired, and they were having their Social Security garnished to pay back these student loans.
My goodness.
The way student loans function in this country is a very draconian system. I mean, there's not really another type of debt that works like that.
Well, Doug, go ahead, Dr. Alexander.
Yeah, if I can also point out that they turned, so Corinthians, the students who when Corinthian ICT Institute closed, they turned to the Department of Education and basically have put the pressure on the public to offset the student loans, of which Corinthian and ITT Institute have basically taken the money and run. So the students now are asking the public or the Department of Education to bail them out, which is a legitimate concern. However, the problem is the ITT board members, the Corinthian College board members, the ones that put them into this debt and then closed their doors on a Wednesday morning, are the ones that they're asking the public to pay twice for something that wasn't worth anything from the beginning.
What is the cost of tuition at some of these schools, like on the East Coast, these prestigious schools? It'd be great to get a degree from there, but is the investment really worth, based on what you're telling me, we're talking several thousands of dollars a semester.
There are about 100 schools now that are charging about $70,000 a year, and our point is we've tried to make the outcomes, which are starting salaries, student indebtedness, we have fought hard to make sure that everybody is armed with the right information so they can make the right decisions. And there are a lot of schools, particularly in the East Coast, the Northeast Coast, that have fought us every step of the way to not make that information available to consumers, parents, and students.
877-217-5757 is your number. We'll spend a few more minutes with President King Alexander of Louisiana State University and also hear more from Alexander Chabanneau. He is the director of Fail State, which premieres the Louisiana International Film Festival. This one is at LSU, Patrick Taylor Hall, 7:30 on Wednesday night. And we'll return with more Talk Louisiana after this pause for the news on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. Pleased to have you with us for Talk Louisiana. Your number is 877-217-5757. Allie Baltazar and Becca Dill are producing, and we have a few more minutes with President King Alexander of LSU and Director Alexander Chabanneau, whose production Fail State will show this Wednesday, 7:30 p.m., Patrick Taylor Hall at LSU, and it's about the student loan crisis in America. And as we went to the break, President Alexander was discussing how it is in other places that there are over 100 universities in which the annual payment from students is $70,000 a year. So many, as you can imagine, would get student loans. And we're talking over $250,000 in debt some of these students are in as they head off to start a career. That's a very difficult hurdle to climb, isn't it?
It certainly is. And I think that the average undergraduate today, 82% will graduate with debt, and there are a lot of universities out there that roughly around 40% or 30% like we are, but we want parents and students to know that before they invest in such a major undertaking for the next 4, 5, or 6 years of their lives. And the more information makes the market, higher education marketplace, work better, but there are a lot of institutions that do not want that information out there.
Well, is there a solution? Is there something that can be done to alleviate this crisis?
Well, one way that helps is the current accountability and transparency bill that Senator Cassidy, Senator Warren, and Senator Hatch have actually put on the Senate side. This actually gets a lot more information in the hands of parents, students, guidance counselors, principals. And we are convinced that the more people know about higher ed, about student indebtedness, about the value of what they're investing in, the better they're equipped in making the right decisions that keep them out of student loan debt.
Question to both President Alexander and to Alexander Chabanneau from Jeffrey Hobson. He asks, should institutions of higher learning require students to take personal finance classes to handle these kinds of issues as they leave school with debt, which they need to learn how to manage? What do you think, President Alexander?
I think it's a very valid question and a good point. Students must know that this isn't easy money. These are loans that that will follow them throughout their lifetime. And the more we make information available to parents and students and to let them know that this is not simply easy money, but it's the only debt that they can't file for bankruptcy on right now. So I think it's a great question. It's something we all should be doing more of, and I really appreciate the point.
All right. Alexander Chabanneau, what do you think as far as making sure students are aware of the hole they're in before they leave the gates of whatever campus they're attending school at?
Could you repeat that question, Jim?
As far as having personal finance classes that would be a requirement before students leave campus and get their degrees.
I think it's definitely necessary. I think, more information never hurts in this situation. I would stress, though, when it comes to the for-profit colleges, they've been shown to mislead, manipulate any student into enrolling to the point where, they'll use personal tragedy against the student to get them to enroll and to sign on, to take out almost $90,000 in debt to attend IDD Tech. I think solution-wise, it's a combination of more information to the consumer, but also just stronger mm-hmm. oversight of the college system, but specifically in for-profit colleges. There isn't a sheriff on this beat right now. In the previous administration, it was, weak to, all right. In this current administration, it's very friendly to the for-profit college industry, and they're gutting what little regulations there were in place already. Mm-hmm. And it's unfortunate. I mean, in a lot of cases with the for-profit colleges, the target market of this industry are students from very low-income backgrounds. They're veterans, they're service members, who in a lot of cases are looking for, a way to the middle class. And these for-profit colleges, they peddle on the dreams of these people. And so I think in a lot of instances, these schools, some of these for-profits, they have 10-15% graduation rates, and they have to disclose those numbers to students. But the way they pose it to these students is, you'll be the 10%, you'll be that 15% that goes on to graduate, and you will go on and, make 80,000 years as a medical assistant when, the average starting salary is way below $35,000.
All right. We're short on time, but a listener asks about whether there will be a conversation among some of the people who are going to be on hand Wednesday. Will there be a conversation beyond the actual showing of fail state?
Yes. So there's going to be a panel that President Alexander from LSU is going to be moderating, and we have the chancellor from Baton Rouge Community Colleges, Chancellor Stide, who's going to be right on hand with me to do a panel.
Very good. And so the time I have for the screening is 7:30. When does the panel discussion take place?
Right after the viewing, about an hour and a half after the video starts, yeah, which will be about 9:00.
Okay, 9:00 in King Alexander. I know this is an issue near and dear to you, and for those who talk about TOPS and weigh the benefits and perhaps the drawbacks of that program, one of the benefits is that it enables students, not only at LSU, but at other state universities, to not have this kind of a burden when they leave campus, when they get their degrees.
And you're exactly right. It's a combination of many factors, both being lower than most institutions in what we charge, but also the fact that TOPS helps many of our students. That's why only about 38% of LSU graduates, undergrads, graduate with debt. As I mentioned, the national average is about 82%. But that's a significant issue that is peppering all the newspapers throughout the country and magazines, and will continue.
Thank you so much, President King Alexander and Alexander Chabanneau, the director of Fail State. And again, it's Wednesday, this Wednesday, the 18th, 7:30, Patrick Taylor Hall. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you, Jim.
Take care. See you soon. And now we're joined in studio by Chris Cangelosi, who's involved intricately and intimately with Dancing with the Stars, and she's brought one of those whose performer, Michael Uffman, with her. Chris, this has been going on how long now in Baton Rouge?
Well, this is our 12th year, and we're actually having the celebration of Terry Cirio, who we're going to be honoring this year, who actually started the Big Buddy Dancing with the Stars back 12 years ago. She passed away not too long ago, so we're definitely honoring her this year. So this is our 12th year, and we're very excited about it.
You should be. Who are some of those who will be participating, some of the local celebrities?
Well, we've got Dr. Steve Sherman, who we're looking forward to do his musical theater with, Jerice Grantham. We've got Dr. Johnny Hunt will be dancing with River Peterson. We've got Gina Lair, who will be dancing with Van Bo. We've also got Dawn Stearns. We have Brandon Seho. We have Christy McKern. And we also have the Patels, Ruben and Manisha. So we're really excited about the selection process this year. They always have either have come to the event and they have friends that have danced in the past. Mm-hmm. And they recommend their friends to dance the following year. So that's where a lot of our dancers come from.
And this is for Big Buddy. And it's a week from Saturday.
It's April 28th at the PMAC.
At the PMAC, where it's been, I guess,
since
from the
beginning,
start.
Yeah. Yes.
And you've got Michael Uffman here.
I sure do, and he's got probably a lot to say about his dance.
Well, Michael, it's amazing how people, they will train almost year-round for this one night, these few minutes of glory. And sometimes people really put on a show, and then others, they don't do as well as they hoped. It's a pressure situation, isn't it?
It is. I can promise a show on my behalf. It may be a show that people don't want to see again, ever again, or they may want to forget. But it is. We've been practicing since October, actually.
Since October.
Since October.
6 months.
Yes, correct. And so we started it once a week, and then lately it's been kind of, as you start to feel the pressure cooker, we've kind of picked it up.
Wow. So when you say you've been practicing, how does that work? You've got your partner, right?
Correct.
So
I'll be dancing with...
You've gotten quite familiar.
I have. Her name is Ariana Virgilio. She's awesome, and I got to give her a shout-out because it's amazing how much time and effort these professional dancers mm-hmm. put in, and they have no idea the lack of talent that I'm bringing to the table. So she really has spent a lot of time molding me, teaching me dance moves, teaching me lifts, all these things. I've dropped her on the floor probably 100 times. So there's a lot of bumps and bruises, and it's been a good time, though.
And the wardrobe's a big part of the event, too. I'm sure you have quite an impressive outfit for Saturday.
I do. I can't give away too much, but I've got some flames in my outfit. And I've never bought a pair of dance shoes until a few weeks ago. So, yes, got some new wardrobes.
Mm-hmm. Well, it has taken a life of its own. I don't know how many other communities do this, but Baton Rouge certainly has embraced this concept full bore.
Oh, yeah. Everyone loves to be involved. We already had a waiting list for the next couple of years. They are ready to put their dance shoes on and give it a whirl. Like you did say earlier, some people do put a lot of time invested into this show, and they do start right away once the selection is started in October, and it goes all the way through April. So we're really excited about the upcoming cast that's going to be on stage April 28th.
It's the 12th annual Dancing with the Stars Baton Rouge at the PMAC, the LSU Assembly Center, on the 28th, a week from Saturday, and that you get started when?
We get started at 6 o'clock. The doors will open. The show will start right at 7 o'clock. It'll go to 9:30, and you'll actually get to see the excitement of the mm-hmm. little buddies performing at the intermission time for the table challenge.
Who are the judges?
Ah, the judges are Ted James, Kathy Victorian, and Pam Bordelon.
Ah, you got quite a trio there.
Yes, we do.
That should be very good. And is there a host?
Our host is from WBRZ. We have John Pastorek and Sylvia Weatherspoon.
And they've done it in the past, and I'm sure they'll do a fine job again. And for those who would like more information on tickets, what do we do?
BigBuddyProgram.org. Please give us a call at 388-9737. You can buy your tickets through the Big Buddy office, or you can go online.
All right. Well, thank you, Chris Cangelosi, and thank you, Michael Uffman, and good luck.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll be back with General Honoré. That's the plan after this pause on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. And we round out the show this hour with General Russell Honoré, the Green Army, the man who was the fellow who brought Louisiana back from Katrina. Now, 13 years ago, almost 13 years. And we're going to talk about what's happened with the BP victims 8 years after the oil spill involving the Deepwater Horizon. But General Honoré has also been spending some quality time at the state capitol in recent days. There is a session going on. How is the legislative session going for the Green Army, General?
Well, between wins and losses, we've lost more than we won, Jim. But in the long run, we've put some big dents in the things we needed to change concerning monitoring clean air and clean water. And we're not done yet, and we're looking for a resolution or two still to be filed. But thanks for asking.
Well, what do you have in the offing in the remaining days of the session?
Oh, we have a bill monitoring air. We presented that bill a week ago by Representative Katrina Jackson. It basically deals with the authority of the DEQ to require companies, after they've had two emergencies in a three-year period, require them to put air monitors. And we weren't able to get it through committee the first time around, but we're going back this week, and Natural Resources will give it another shot. It's a very reasonable bill, but we're up against some very skilled and very well-resourced lobbyists who have gotten to that committee in Natural Resources. So we're going to go back and try to give it another swing, Jim.
All right. Well, some would say, why would anybody be against clean air? But there are pressures and industry concerns. We want jobs, too. How do we strike a balance?
Oh, we got jobs. But for us to enjoy the bounty of those jobs, we need to be in good health. And not all communities have safe air. Things happen in industry. Accidents happen. And all we're asking for, or sometimes equipment's failed, or sometimes the standard isn't high enough on the amount of emissions, or low enough on the amount of emissions to get people sick. And I think the first requirement of the Constitution, as described in Article 9, is the safety of the people, not the profit of the company. And none of this we do would close companies. It would cause them to invest more in making the air safe. So that's what the Constitution and state says. However, they've been able to sway that committee to make the committee believe that we want to close them. It's not about closing companies. It's about making them compliant with the Clean Air Act and protecting our people. Our people should not have to suffer. We had one legislator, a lady, Jim, in the Natural Resource Committee, that said pollution was the smell of money. I never thought I would hear that in the 21st century. Shame on us.
You actually heard that in a committee hearing?
Yeah, last week. You go back and look at it on tape.
Pollution is the smell of money?
The smell of money, yes, sir.
Industry has big clout, not only here, but throughout the country. But is it especially so the case, in your estimation, in Louisiana?
Well, I think we are this industry has such a big impact on our communities, and it is a economic driver between here and New Orleans. We have over 100 plants of one sort or the other. So it does dominate the economy and dominates the donor list that our legislators look to get reelected. So it is a dominant player, and they have some very high prices lobbyists that influence them, that have them come up and say stupid stuff like pollution is the smell of money. I mean, it's unbelievable that they would go past what the constituents tell them, that the smell is not healthy, the smell or the plant is emitting particles that land on the car or it's making them sick. But we want to get that bill through. We're going back at them hard again this week, Jim.
All right, we have a opportunity to take a call or two for General Honore, and we also want to talk to him about this press conference last Friday regarding BP. Phil in Jefferson Terrace, please be brief. You're on with General Honore. Hi, Phil.
Hi, Jim, and hi, Mr. Honore. It's my honor to speak to you. My question is this. If you go out to Henderson Swamp and the Chapalaya Delta, you can see with your own eyes the damage that those spoil banks have done. They stopped the flow of water. Where are we on those lawsuits? And just thank you for your work. Appreciate you, sir.
Well, I appreciate you asking a question about the spoil banks. We had a resolution last year in the legislature, put together a task force at the direction of Senator Fred Mills, sponsored that resolution. And we studied the impact of those spoil banks and what to do about them. We don't have a solution. The Department of Natural Resources has failed to act. The Department of Compensation has failed to act. The Corps of Engineers failed to act. Many of those fall banks run east-west, which block the flow of water that goes north-south. They create diversions. They block water. They create a sediment buildup. And now they create woodlands that that can be used for hunting. But they're very disruptive. They disrupt the crawfishermen who are trying to get those crawfish to us so we can consume them and ship them all over the world. But the spoil banks are a major disruptor. It's a shame on the Corps engineers and our state agencies to allow those spoil banks to be not adjusted so the water can flow through them. Some of the spoil banks are taller, Jim, than the levees that bound the Chaffalot Basin. It's a crying shame.
Well, last Friday you had a press conference in front of the federal court building in downtown New Orleans pertaining to medical benefit claims in the BP Horizon, Deepwater Horizon catastrophe. What is your concern on this front?
Yeah, it's actually it's going to happen this Friday, Jim. I'm sorry. It's going to be the 20th at 10:30 in the morning, federal building in New Orleans, federal courthouse. And we come on the eighth-year memorial of BP.
Anniversary, yes.
Yes, sir. And what's happening is in those 8 years, there's people that have been left out. The people that were left out of the claims process up to this point, many of them were oil field or people who went out and cleaned the beaches and the swamps, and they put in medical claims. Most of them did not get their claims resolved, and now they're in the hands of the claims administrator, which is supervised by Judge Barbier down in New Orleans. And it's shameful to see the few people that did get some claims adjusted, and now we have thousands of them 8 years later that haven't been to court. And it's like BP is using the old Exxon Valdez playbook, wait until most of the people die before they settle the claims. And we're bringing attention to that by, in the front of the federal courthouse, at a news conference at 10:30 in the morning in New Orleans on Friday the 20th, the actual date. And on the 21st, Jim, a vicinity of the City Hall in New Orleans, we're going to have a rally. Both of these, you can see them online on Facebook. We have the posted BP survivors. You can look that up with your specific time, location, and the speakers we're going to bring forward, actual survivors who will tell their family stories. Because, Jim, in some cases, the dads died and left mom with four or five children to take care of, and they still don't have a claim adjusted.
All right, this is at 500 Poydras Street, the federal court building, downtown New Orleans, and I misspoke a moment ago. It will be this Friday, the 20th, which will be the eighth anniversary of the BP oil spill. Now, I've seen some of these figures. I think there were 37,000 medical benefit claims submitted by cleanup workers, first responders, and coastal residents. How many have been paid of those 37,000?
40.
40 as in 40, 40.
Yes, sir. Of 37,226. That's a crying shame. On the other hand, Jim, we've got people in Florida, Alabama, and Mississippi who timeshares lost money. They got paid. Can you believe that? But the people who actually did the cleanup and have come out with medical issues have not been paid. And these claim administrators, which are assigned in collaboration with the Eastern Federal Court of Louisiana, they've got paid. They got paid over $700 million, these lawyers, who have settled the first round of claims. That's a crying shame. Yet the people who worked after OSHA told BP the people must have cleanup suits, they've disregarded that. Before they gave it to them, some of them never had them. They were not screened properly once the work was done. They were released to go home. and then to try and go through a claim system that's been absolutely. And now 8 years later, they have not had their day in court. And you might ask, well, why is Honore fooling with that? Well, that's what I do. That's what.
All right. We do have to roll, but it is this Friday, Federal Courthouse, New Orleans, 500 Poitras Street, 1030. And it'll address this issue involving unpaid claims for medical benefits. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back tomorrow. Stay tuned.
For a podcast of today's show, go to WRKF.org or find the Talk Louisiana podcast on the WRKF app. We welcome your feedback and topic suggestions. Email us at talk@talklouisiana.org. Talk Louisiana is a production of WRKF in Baton Rouge.